You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, 5 lectures, entitled At Home in the Universe, Exploring Our Suprasensory Nature. This is lecture 3, entitled Through the Spheres, given on the afternoon of November 17, 1923. In our first lecture, we try to form an idea of how earthly humankind is related to beings and forces in the realms beyond Earth. In the second lecture, we considered from a certain standpoint the human passage through the spiritual world between death and a new birth. Now, in this lecture, I want to go a little farther, adding to what was said before. As our study proceeds, we will conclude our discussions with an harmonious, self-contained picture. We have seen that human beings pass through the gate of death and enter the suprasensory realm. There, they reveal themselves to imagination as in spiritual form. Please understand that perception of spirit is very different from perceiving an object in the world of senses. For example, those endowed with spiritual vision will tell you that when they perceived this or that, they could not tell you its size, and so on. Phenomena of the spiritual realm are not spatial, the way material objects are to the physical eye. Nevertheless, if we want to describe them, we can do so in such a way that they resemble an image seen physically, or some other earthly terminology might be used to describe it. So I ask you to consider this while I describe such things. When a human being has passed through the gate of death, the gradually fades. On the other hand, the rest of one's form becomes a kind of physiognomy. This countenance expresses, for example, how good or bad or how wise or foolish a person was in earthly life. Everything we can hide in the sensory world, where villains are able to maintain absolutely innocent faces, can no longer be hidden once we pass through the gate of death. Your face cannot hide it, because one's face fades immediately, and the rest of one's form becomes a physiognomy that allows nothing to be denied. The point here is that after we have passed into the spiritual world, our whole relationship to the universe changes. We must realize that the faculty of thinking, especially the kind of abstract thinking we consider so important on Earth, has absolutely no value in the spiritual world. The faculty that uses the head as its apparatus is completely without value in the spiritual world. We cannot use it there. We must abandon the kind of thinking of which we are so proud, through which we develop our concepts of material phenomena. Philosophers exist only on Earth because it is precisely philosophical, abstract thinking that is left behind. The further we penetrate the spiritual world, the more completely our soul life becomes perception, a kind of sight whereby the thoughts underlying things are conveyed to us along with seeing. On earth, we develop thoughts. In the spirit world, the things themselves reveal thoughts, which come to us. Thought is accomplished there through perception. And this is true of not only thought, indeed, all of our experience in the spiritual world comes to us through perception. In the sense-perceptible world, we have certain references to help us describe the spiritual in which we live between death and a new birth. In the realm of the senses, we see stars and the planets of our system, and they reveal only their outer nature to our senses. Their inner reality is very different. They are the gathering of spiritual beings who have come together in diverse ways where stars appear in the heavens. When we observe a star with our physical eyes, there is in fact a community of spiritual beings at that place in the cosmos. The physical star we see shows us only the direction, a signpost or chart. Conventional scientific descriptions of stars have very little meaning because they deal only with those signposts or charts to orient our vision. When we see a star somewhere in the sky, it indicates the location of a community of spiritual beings. We go first to the moon sphere after death, that is, to the region of spiritual beings who dwell within that sphere. What sort of things are they? If you read my title Outline of Esoteric Science, you know that the moon has not always been out in the heavens where it now is now. The moon sphere is characterized by strange facts. For example, it is very peculiar that conventional textbooks do not mention that the moon comes closer to Earth each year. Because this fact is not in textbooks, most people are unaware of it. It is true, nevertheless. The moon was not always out in the cosmos. Indeed, at one time, the moon and its substance existed within the Earth. You can read about this in Title and Outline of Esoteric Science. The moon split off from Earth and went out into space. Consequently, the moon as such became a dwelling for spiritual beings during earthly evolution. And who are those spiritual beings? I have often described in books and lectures the great primordial teachers who lived among humankind during the very early times of Earth's evolution. Footnote: see especially Chapter 6, titled Cosmic and Human Evolution, Now and in the Future, from An Outline of Esoteric Science. End of footnote. When we recall that ancient time with true understanding, it fills us with deep reverence for the marvelous wisdom that human beings on Earth were given long ago by those great superior human teachers. Those first teachers of earthly humanity were not human themselves, but were higher than humanity in the evolutionary continuum. They did not appear physically in the mysteries, but in etheric bodies, which they have for the most part set aside since that time, dwelling today in astral bodies. These primordial teachers left Earth and went into the cosmos to the moon. The celestial body we know as the moon is thus a dwelling in the cosmos for the primordial teachers of humanity. To coarse perception, the moon's outer aspect merely reflects sunlight. But to finer perception, the moon mirrors a myriad of cosmic forces. But the cosmic forces reflected down to Earth are related to all that is subhuman in us as human beings, that is, what we share with animal nature. Strangely enough, as a result, the moon unites those higher spiritual beings who were once primordial teachers with the animal forces in human nature. This is the first realm that human beings enter after passing through the gate of death. Our first experiences occur there. Imagine as vividly as possible how in our moral or immoral physiognomy we enter that realm of physical and spiritual radiation from the moon, and how we initially see ourselves and others in these physiognomies. We do not perceive the beings of that region with our physical eyes, but with a feeling or touching at a distance. Let me try to describe this to you. Imagine that we come up to another being in this region. Our physiognomy is pliant and soft, so to speak. When we are near another being, we try to assume a physiognomy similar to the one revealed by the other. But if one who had been a scoundrel during earthly life were to arrive in the moon sphere and attempt to assume the physiognomy and experience of one who was truly virtuous, in order to feel what it is like to be that person, such an attempt would fail. A scoundrel can produce only a scoundrel's physiognomy, nothing else. Thus you can see that for a certain period of time after death, we perceive only those human beings who had a similar moral nature as our own during earthly life. This is the first impression of judgment that we experience. We actually experience these events as the administration of strict justice. This exerts a harsh justice. There is a constant impression that you are exactly like those you perceive. You move only among those like yourself and see no other kinds of beings. One simply does not perceive them at all. The particular forces of this moon environment are such that the Angeloi, with their beautiful forms, are not permitted to associate immediately with human beings. The moon was cast off by the earth. It is the cosmic body that earth ejected into cosmic space, though it is also true that the great holy primordial teachers of the human race went with it. But Ahrimanic forces are near its present isolated place in the cosmos. Ahrimanic forms may be seen there. Consequently, when you see another human being with an immoral physiognomy, you have the impression that you are seeing yourself with those Ahrimanic forms. And in despair, you realize that you actually resemble those forms that appear there. We do not yet perceive the Angeloi, because we are inwardly unlike their forms. Thus we perceive other human beings in certain evil shapes, and can see how similar they are to Ahrimanic forms. That is our second impression in the moon sphere, our close resemblance to Ahrimanic forms. This is another very effective form of judgment after death. Our third experience is that we cannot avoid the distinct impression that the good primordial teachers of humanity are present in the first region through which we must roam. This impression is unavoidable because there is a strange relationship between the Ahrimanic beings we encounter, as described, and those earliest teachers of humanity. From the perspective of human beings, of course, it is understandable that when it comes to judging the sort of things I am speaking of, they tend to have the same attitude as that famous king of Spain, when he was shown a map of the stars and their movements, as well as the whole solar system, he found it too difficult to understand. He said that the universe was far too complicated, and that if God had allowed him to create it, he would have made a much simpler universe. It's not surprising that many people think much like this, and always want to correct the divine, universal, cosmic plan. Human beings believe they are extremely capable when it comes to understanding. Indeed, there was once a philosopher who said, quote, "Give me matter, and I will make a universe," close quote. This was Kant. It's a good thing he was not given any matter. He would have made something appalling with it. Similarly, when people hear about Ahrimanic beings, they fail to understand why such beings did not give up all hope long ago of conquering the earth spirits. Human beings know very well that Ahrimanic beings will not be victorious. Ahriman, however, is unaware of this and works unceasingly for victory. Through his efforts to win, a peculiar relationship arises between Ahrimanic beings, who belong primarily to the moon sphere, and the wise primordial teachers of humanity. There is terrible flattery on the part of Ahrimanic beings toward the teachers of humanity, whom they would like to win over to their side. After all, what are those Ahrimanic beings trying to do? Their goal is to arrest earthly development at a certain point and prevent it from further progress. It is always Ahriman who says, quote, "Human beings have brought their evolution thus far. Now they must stop and go no further. I want them to harden into their present condition and continue on their cosmic journey as ossified creatures, not as evolving human beings." Close quote. Ahrimanic beings whisper these things into our ears every night. It is what they want to happen to the whole earth. They wish to stop its evolution at a certain point. Now, consider the great primordial teachers of humanity in this sense. They left behind on earth the ancient primordial wisdom taught in the old mysteries, but it has dimmed through the ages and is no longer understood. The teaching of this ancient wisdom could not continue, because if we had continued to receive it, we would not have progressed. Above all, we would not have gained the possibility of freedom. We would not have free will. Wisdom could speak only to human instinct, not to clear self-awareness. Consequently, for the benefit of humanity, these great teachers withdrew at a particular point in time. If the primordial teachers had never lived on earth, humanity would never have found the beginning of its evolution. But once they had provided the catalyst for independent human evolution, they left earth and went to the community of the moon. The Ahrimanic beings did all they could to hold the primordial teachers on earth and to keep the instinctive nature of wisdom as it was. And even today, they still believe that when human beings pass through the gate of death and arrive in the moon sphere, something may yet be achieved. So they continually try to flatter and entice those teachers to approach those who have just died. But they cannot attain this goal, especially in relation to those human beings who wear an evil physiognomy. Nevertheless, Ahrimanic beings continuously work on human beings in the moon sphere and taunt them by pointing to the primordial teachers and saying, quote, "That was all once there. It was yours," close quote. Human beings who wear evil features must now pass through a third experience. The Ahrimanic beings describe the primordial teachers to them, but because of their nature, they cannot see those teachers and merely stare into a void. Again, this is a very significant judgmental impression for human beings. Then a feeling begins to weigh heavily on the soul, because one is unable to see those who gave humankind its starting point. One feels repudiated and rejected. This powerfully penetrating experience comes to those without a physiognomy that expresses good. These are the three necessary impressions for those who have a physiognomy of evil when entering the world beyond the gate of death. Of course, one must bear in mind that no one is completely good. After all, there is much that is evil in the very best of us. Consequently, it is the fate of a great number of human beings to experience to some degree the impressions I have described. But the more we can assume the physiognomy of the good after death, the more we are able to see those whom we resemble through goodness, and the less we will be aware of Ahrimanic beings. Now, what I have been saying about Ahrimanic forms gradually disappears from the picture, and we develop a more penetrating awareness of the angelic forms that then enter our sphere. Through this, forces enter into us with which we permeate our being. These are primarily forces of will. After death, our main faculties are not thinking or reflection, but the will. Will becomes feeling or sensing. It becomes the whole realm of life. You see, if we are to have any perception at all, we must exert our will to cause our forms to resemble what we want to see. Consequently, we must will. In other words, we must become similar to what we would like to perceive. After all, it is the will that is developed after we pass through the gate of death. And the impressions of good and evil I described in relation to the moon sphere also work on the will. The next sphere that human beings enter is that of Mercury. Thus far, we have adapted our physiognomy, often at the cost of great suffering, to the powers and forces of the suprasensory world. We have laid aside the physiognomy of evil and gradually come to resemble the forms of angels, archangels, and archai. For many, this process is often slow. Nevertheless, we enter the sphere of Mercury, where the beings of the third hierarchy dwell. We must live there among them and experience what I described. In this region, we gradually understand what had previously been only perception, more or less blind perception, but it worked very powerfully on the human will. In the Mercury sphere, we gradually come to understand everything we have perceived. In our time, those who investigate this through imagination perceive something tragic, because the way we find our way to the Mercury sphere after death depends somewhat on whether or not we were materialists here on Earth. It depends on whether we rejected in thought and action everything of a suprasensory nature, or came to understand such matters here. One who rejected all that transcends the material realm during earthly life now confronts the beings in the Mercury sphere with relatively little understanding. And this is also true for materialists in the next region. Beings there may also be classified as angeloi, archangeloi, and archai, but somewhat higher in their development. In the realm of Venus, materialists confront those beings without understanding, because the beings there radiate cosmic forces of love. This region will be the strangest and most foreign to those who failed to acquire a capacity for love on Earth. In the realm of Venus, the loving forces, which would otherwise pour over those who had acquired a capacity to love here on Earth, now become wrathful forces in those who on Earth harbored hate, whether consciously or unconsciously. It is the mystery of our journey through the Venus sphere that those who bring forces of hatred with them from the Earth now experience Venus's forces of love arising from their will and changing into forces of fury and anger. They see themselves manifested there in a way that motivates them to admit that it must all be softened, mitigated, and made harmonious with the cosmos. Essentially, it is always the will that receives special care and nurturing in the Venus sphere. And the will is grounded in the limb and metabolic system in the lower part of Earth to human beings. As we have seen, this is the aspect of the human being that becomes the entire appearance after death. It is therefore the will grounded there that is now expressed in this way. Also during this time, we continue to develop gradually so that we begin to resemble the beings of the spiritual cosmos, and we eventually enter the sphere of the sun. Everything I have described is also involved in this, but this also gets into other viewpoints that are new, which we must take up later. The forces of the sun sphere work primarily on all that which we have on Earth as a reflection of feeling. When we physically look up at the sun, it reveals only its outer aspect. Inwardly, the sun is the great cosmic gathering place for all of the spiritual beings who from this center guide and direct earthly destinies of human beings and all that is a part of Earth. Above all, the sun is the community of beings of the second hierarchy, exousiae, kyriotetes, and dunamis. When we enter the sun realm, we are met by everything I described in the previous lecture. Whereas, before entering the sun sphere, we lived only among those human beings with whom we are linked by destiny, now others approach us as well, our, in quotes, circle of acquaintances, if I may use such an expression, grows larger. All this takes place now in the sun sphere. It is also here in this sun sphere that an especially strong inner experience arises in us. Below is another world, the earth we left behind and must re-enter. In the sun sphere, what I have spoken of as a transformation of the human being now occurs. Our lower being is transformed into the upper being for the next earthly life. Thus the legs become the spirit form of the lower jaw, the arms, the spirit form of the upper jaw and cheekbones, and so on. This event in the spiritual world is a marvelous work, compared to which any human work on earth is insignificant. All that human beings accomplish there in conjunction with the higher spiritual beings is grand and majestic. We work there together on the mystery of being human. This all takes place in the sun realm in the broader sense. But there is yet another experience for human beings in this realm. If our soul and spirit are healthy during earthly life, we must inevitably get a feeling that another world exists, a spiritual world, though we cannot penetrate it with our knowledge. We take the existence of a spiritual world for granted and say that there is a supersensory world beyond that experience through our senses. Footnote: Rudolf Steiner always speaks of such feelings in relation to a healthy soul and spirit. Quote, "Certainly there are those who believe quite honestly that the dissolution of the physical body annihilates the soul, and they lead their lives accordingly. It is not necessarily true, however, that these people are completely unbiased in their feelings about such thoughts. Yet they do not allow their fear of the soul's annihilation and their desire for its continuation to overshadow their reasoning. To that extent, their ideas are often more objective than those whose unconscious belief in the soul's continuing life is based upon a veiled, burning desire for that continuation. Still, the level of prejudice among the deniers of immortality is not less than it is among believers. It is only different." Close quote from A Way of Self-Knowledge, pages 106 and 107, end of footnote. During our existence in the sun sphere between death and a new birth, however, the situation is reversed. Our experience there is such that we speak of a world beyond. Here, however, it is the earth that is beyond. It is an intensely alive feeling that awakens in us, not so much concerning one's personal destiny, but for the whole essential nature of the earth. There is one such characteristic that you can observe and test for yourselves. You should try it, though people today will find it difficult. When you study history and follow it back through the centuries, you can always have a certain kind of experience. You are alive now, in our own time. Go back through history, through the World War, to earlier and earlier events, until finally you arrive at an historical period back to, let's say, about 1500 or 1550. It begins to feel familiar to you. Consider for a moment such intimate human knowledge. Something that lies far in the past seems familiar. You think that this must be something you experienced yourself. Superficial people immediately conclude that this was the period of a previous earthly incarnation. Usually, however, this is not the case. Usually, it is instead the time between death and rebirth in the sun sphere, when you experienced most vividly a connection with earthly existence. It was the year when the earthly life presented itself to you in the sun existence as a beyond, just as the opposite happens on earth, where suprasensory life presents itself to you as beyond. Let's pause for a moment in considering our path of development after death. We saw that once we have moved away from the earth, we complete the moon existence first. Then we enter the spheres of Mercury, Venus, and Sun, and we continue on from there. Later we will speak of what follows. None of these events in the spiritual world are isolated. They are also connected to events on earth. And this leads to a very special relationship. Moon existence is thoroughly permeated with the great primordial teachers of humanity, whom we have often mentioned. In very remote antiquity, they left earth and went into the cosmos to form a cosmic community on the moon. But there were various people who had been initiated into the mysteries and later retained a truly living inner vision and hearing of the knowledge that had existed on earth as the result of those primordial initiates. Consequently, in the mysteries of the ancient Indian period of civilization, there was still a living knowledge of the moon initiate's wisdom. Footnote: the whole span of cosmic evolution is described in title An Outline of Esoteric Science. Quote, Cosmic Evolution and the Human Being, close quote, on the post-Atlantean civilization of ancient India, see pages 252 to 258, end of footnote. This is where we must look for the source of what we can still marvel at today as the echoes of ancient Indian wisdom. Nor is this all. A twofold event took place. During various later eras, people also felt the influence of the suprasensory realm through which we wander between death and rebirth, though it gradually changed and lessened with each era. In other words, people became less aware of it. The influence that Mercury exerted, for example, was especially strong during the ancient Persian period, but people were less aware of it. Because of this, they developed the myth of Ahura Mazda, which was a dim cognition of Mercury's influence on Earth. During the Egypto-Chaldean era, the active influences were mainly those of Venus. Then came the wonderful era of Greek culture, which continued in that of the Romans. It was during this Greco-Latin culture that the sun influences affected Earth most strongly from the spiritual world. But humanity was the least aware of such influences during the Greco-Latin period. This was also when two things came together. First, during our existence between death and a new birth, when we enter the sun's sphere, we feel an intense longing to sense the earth from the sun. On the other hand, everything related to the sun and its nature had a strong influence on the Greeks. All the sun forces given to Earth had deep significance for them, especially those known as Athenians, in contrast to the Spartans. Yet everything related to the sun, including its spiritual aspect, exerted a remarkably deep cosmic influence on Greece and the whole configuration of the Greek civilization. Throughout this phase of evolution, there was an especially strong capacity on Earth to perceive the purely spiritual nature of the starry heavens. Our material perception of the heavens did not really begin until our fifth post-Atlantean period, which began in the 15th century, and is thus only a few hundred years old. We have, however, already gone past the region where earthly human beings sense a relationship to the influences they feel between death and a new birth within the sun existence. Today we sense something else much more. Indeed, after the period in the sun, we enter the realm of the Mars existence. The strongest cosmic influence exerted on humanity today is that of the Mars existence. And we come to know those influences after experiencing the, in quotes, noonday of our life after death, when we turn back toward Earth. But this entry to the Mars sphere after death does not mean that the sun existence ceases to influence us, because the sun extends its sphere of influence over all the rest of the planetary states as well. This continues, but the Mars existence becomes significant for what is now happening on Earth. I will speak more of our journey through Mars existence, but for now, I want to connect what we have learned of the spiritual world with what we find specifically active in our own fifth post-Atlantean age. We are now becoming acquainted with the nature of cosmic battle. We sense it. Most people cannot unravel its mysteries. But a war is being waged in the cosmos between all sorts of good and evil spirits. What we have called the sun existence assumes special significance for our age. It is very difficult today for spiritual understanding to hold its own against conventional scientific materialism. People are proud of having investigated the sun from a physical perspective. The sun is described in scientific books, but such descriptions are unable to convey correct concepts of the sun In particular, how does the sun work in relation to the earth today? I will point out only one of its activities. It might seem now that I am descending into truly material realms, which may appear strange in contrast to the spiritual events described thus far. What I have to say, however, is important to the progress of our studies. Of course, you are familiar with a phenomenon called sunspots, which appear with a certain regularity. Footnote: conventional science describes sunspots as dark, usually irregularly shaped spots on the sun's surface and considered to be solar magnetic storms. The temperature of the spots is lower than that of the surrounding photosphere. Thus the spots are, by contrast, darker. All but the smallest show a dark central portion, the umbra, with a lighter outer area, the penumbra. Sunspot activity peaks every 11 years. End of footnote. These are dark spots that appear on the sun. Sunspots and their meaning have caused much dispute in materialistic science. But if we were to examine them more exactly, we would find that the sun is inwardly prompted to eject sun substance, in quotes, into space through these dark openings. And the substance that is cast out appears in our solar system as comets, meteors, and shooting stars. Particularly during our age, those beings who rule the universe from within the sun cast out comets, meteors, and shooting stars. They did so in earlier times as well, but now this activity has a new significance. That is why I said that during earlier times, it was mainly the spiritual impulses emanating from the star system that worked. Now the forces contained in the iron cast out of the sun begin to have a special significance for human beings. These impulses are used by the spiritual being we call Michael, who serves the spirit in the cosmos. So something not present before, to this degree, has appeared in the cosmos during our time. Cosmic iron, with its spiritual significance, makes it possible for Michael to mediate between the suprasensory and the sense-perceptible earthly phenomena. Consequently, in our time, we encounter something of a warlike spirit in the world we enter when we go beyond physical existence. In our epoch, when we attain suprasensory insight, cross the threshold, and rather than concentrating on personal matters, focus on the larger cosmic concerns underlying our whole civilization, we gaze into that other world and perceive battle, strife, and spiritual warfare there. Strife, war, and conflict are behind the scenes of existence in the spiritual realm. What the sun spirits eject into space as iron, in a form that becomes physical, also becomes, in the broadest sense, Michael's armor as he accomplishes his task in the cosmic battle to help humanity progress in the face of strife and war, the forces behind the scenes of today's civilization. On the one hand, there is war and strife. On the other, the work of Michael. Footnote: see the Michael letters in title Anthroposophical Leading Thoughts, Rudolf Steiner Press, London, 1998. End of footnote. Again, this all relates to the development of human freedom. As you can see, as earthly human beings, our blood contains iron. Even if we had no iron in our blood, the impulse and feeling for freedom would still arise in our souls, but our bodies would be unable to act on that impulse. Because we can learn how Michael is able to use cosmic iron, which was also cast out in former times, we can not only understand the concept of freedom and its impulse, but we can also sense the body's power to carry the impulse of freedom. By understanding the Michael impulse correctly, we can learn how to use the iron within us for spiritual freedom. External matter has meaning to us only when we understand it as an expression of spirit in the world. In our age, we must learn to use the iron in our blood properly. Wherever there is iron, there is also a cosmic or human impulse to develop freedom. It was out of deep inherent knowledge that the ancient initiates ascribed iron to Mars, with its importance for human blood. Iron also has importance for the cosmos. We can understand these things today through a renewed spiritual science. It is not a matter of reviving ancient traditions, but one of rediscovery through spiritual science itself. When anthroposophy happens to agree with ancient lore, it does not mean that anthroposophy merely revives what is old. Anthroposophy investigates and studies matters in terms of their own essential nature. These things regain their meaning when we see how such knowledge once belonged to human beings through the influence of the primordial divine wisdom of the beings who left Earth for the moon and who live today in the community of the moon. And so, our age is also connected with what we experience between death and rebirth. Therefore, the perception of earthly occurrences is strongest while we are in the sun sphere, though it is always present to some degree after we die. Between death and a new birth, we continually look back to the earthly realm from the super-earthly regions. If we did not, the earthly realm would become alien to us during our long journey between death and rebirth. Human experiences in the suprasensory world can be described in a myriad of ways. Yesterday, I described them to you one way, and now I have described them to you in relation to the starry world and in connection with what takes place on Earth during successive human cultures. All of these things must be brought gradually into a whole. No one should come and say, quote, "One time he described our passage through the period between death and rebirth one way, and then another time he described it very differently." Close quote. If you go to a city once, twice, or even three times, you will certainly describe different things differently according to what you learn about the city each time. Eventually, you must bring all the details of your descriptions together. Similarly, the descriptions of human experiences in the suprasensory world must be brought together and then looked at and pondered together. Only then can we get an impression of the real nature of the suprasensory world and what we experience there. That is as far as I wanted to go for now. In today's second lecture, I will continue from here and describe our further experiences between death and new birth. The end of Lecture 3.